We're back in 2 Samuel chapter 9. The Davidic utopia continued, right? We'll see how things continue to fare. But at the moment, we're in this time in David's reign where things are consolidating. He's reigning over a united kingdom of Israel and Judah. He has established himself at Jerusalem. He has a place. He now has a promise that his son will be on the throne after him and will build a temple that David is already collecting the financing for. That's more details are given on that in Chronicles, but we've already noted some of the spoil that David is taking and specifically devoting to the Lord in view of his son building that temple. He has a lot of sons. We have not yet met the son who will build that temple, but he has a lot to choose from. So. And that brings us to chapter 9. Let's read that together. Before we do, we left last week wondering, right? David and Jonathan had made this covenant, right? Jonathan's dead. Jonathan is, in a sense, released from the continuing requirements of that covenant, although he kept that covenant faithfully throughout David's lifetime, right? But he specifically required of David a promise that after he himself was gone, David would show loving kindness and faithfulness to his descendants, right? A poignant promise in light of the antagonism between the house of Saul and the house of David, right? And would a son of Jonathan necessarily bear Jonathan's disposition toward David, right? Or would they take on the larger disposition of the house of Saul toward David, right? So it's a risky promise for David to commit himself to. And that promise has been in the background, and now it's going to come back up. So, chapter 9. And David said, "Is there still anyone left of the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake?" Now there was a servant of the house of Saul whose name was Ziba, and they called him to David. And the king said to him, "Are you Ziba?" And he said, "I am your servant." And the king said, "Is there not still someone of the house of Saul that I may show the kindness of God to him?" Ziba said to the king, "There is still a son of Jonathan. He is crippled in his feet." The king said to him, "Where is he?" And Ziba said to the king, "He is in the house of Machir, the son of Ammiel, at Lo Debar." Then King David sent and brought him from the house of Machir, the son of Ammiel, at Lo Debar. Pause for a moment. And imagine you are in the shoes of the people around David. Right? David says in verse 1, "Is there still anyone left of the house of Saul?" Right? He asks this question. Is David saying this in front of people, or is David saying this in his heart? Do we know from the text? We don't know. We know about private interactions between David and Jonathan that are not necessarily known to the rest of Israel, right? We have insight into David's character that the people around him may or may not have, right? Especially some of the people involved in this story. So think about, as we read this chapter, and we try and make sense of some of the people's reactions and their reticence and the way they respond to David and the reserve that they show. Think about this from, for instance, Mephibosheth's perspective, right? His family has been David's enemies for a considerable time, right? His father, who had this special relationship with David, is dead and gone. He has been off David's radar for who knows how long, and now suddenly he gets a summons. Think about how that would hit you if you were Mephibosheth, right? Mephibosheth is probably not headed to the palace expecting a party, right? So bear that in mind as we keep reading. There are things that we know as the reader that the people around David don't know. So picking up at verse 5. Then King David sent and brought him from the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, at Lo-debar. And Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, son of Saul, came to David and fell on his face and paid homage. And David said, Mephibosheth. And he answered, Behold, I am your servant. And David said to him, Do not fear, for I will show you kindness for the sake of your father, Jonathan. And I will restore to you all the land of Saul, your father, and you shall eat at my table always. Right? For Mephibosheth, that is the turning point in the encounter. Right? Look at how he enters. Look at how he responds. Look at how he speaks to David. This is utterly unexpected on Mephibosheth's part. And he paid homage and said, What is your servant that you should show regard for a dead dog such as I? Then the king called Ziba, Saul's servant, and said to him, All that belong to Saul and to all his house I have given to your master's grandson. And you and your sons and your servants shall till the land for him, and shall bring in the produce that your master's grandson may have bread to eat. But Mephibosheth, your master's grandson, shall always eat at my table. Now Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. Then Ziba said to the king, According to all that my lord the king commands his servant, so will your servant do. So Mephibosheth ate at David's table like one of the king's sons. And Mephibosheth had a young son whose name was Micah. And all who lived in Ziba's house became Mephibosheth's servants. So Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem, for he ate always at the king's table. Now he was lame in both his feet. How does this strike you? There's a lot going on in this passage. Go ahead. So we have here this beautiful picture of redemption and restoration, of taking one who would be an enemy and bringing them into the household and seating them among the heirs of the household so that they are provided for, so that they are enriched and blessed. Good. If we compare this to other scenes of a similar kind, right? We also have, right, the question of how to deal with a potential enemy, right? We have the exercise of clemency on the part of a powerful ruler, right? Several of these things going on, right? The Romans, especially, valued the idea of clemency, right? A forgiveness or a mercy that is undeserved, that is exercised on the part of one powerful toward one they fought against, right? Part of what is so troubling for Brutus in the midst of the conspiracy toward the end of Julius Caesar's life is that Brutus had been one who fought on the side of Pompey against Caesar in the civil war between these generals. And when Pompey was finally defeated, Julius Caesar exercised clemency toward Brutus and took him on as one he mentored, right? Took him on as a client in a patron-client relationship so that Caesar not just exercised this sort of mercy and grace toward Brutus, but he also took him under his wing, exercised his influence on his behalf, right? Which is part of why Brutus is so torn. Because Brutus has an ancestor, Brutus, right, who fought against the idea of a king, which Caesar seems to be positioning himself as. But he's also loyal to Caesar as an individual, as one who's done this for him, right? And that's not, right, irrelevant to what's going on here. As we'll see in a few chapters, there will be a moment in David's reign where Mephibosheth has an opportunity to once again oppose David and grasp at a kind of power. And that accusation will be leveled against him. Right? So bear that in mind as we continue reading. Right? But what we see here is something of a different character, right? David is not merely exercising some idea of clemency or mercy for the sake of building up his own reputation or increasing his own power or surrounding himself with people who are loyal to him because of this, right? David acts in this way because of his covenant with Jonathan. Right? David is showing covenant faithfulness. He's showing that he is one who keeps promises that he has made before the Lord in this exercise, in this bringing Mephibosheth into the household. And it's not merely, right, a declaration that any hostility or enmity between them is done and over. It's bringing him in, right? Without the background of the covenant, there's a way to read this that is, David is keeping his potential enemies as close as possible, right? But we have the background of that promise, right? That there is a genuine love for Jonathan that motivates this display of love toward Jonathan's son, even as the text continues to highlight that he is also the grandson of Saul, right? So the narrator continually puts before us all of the reasons David should not do this, all of the reasons that it is unwise or dangerous or political suicide for David to do this, right? The narrator continues to put that before us in the way it highlights. For instance, right, David continues to speak of Jonathan, but even in his initial question, right, is there still anyone left of the house of Saul? He doesn't even know if Jonathan has any sons left, but he sees a way that he can keep that promise by extending that love beyond its specific parameters, right, if Jonathan doesn't have sons left. And the narrator keeps pointing back to that, right? In Mephibosheth, verse 6, the son of Jonathan, son of Saul. Right? It could have stopped at son of Jonathan. Again, in verse 7, David will show him kindness by restoring all the land of Saul, his father, right? Then the king called Ziba, Saul's servant, right? Several ways. And then we get a little note in verse 12, that can sound an ominous tone because Mephibosheth has a son, right? So in this exercise of love that David shows, there is yet a risk. Mephibosheth is one who's lame in both feet, is perhaps not a threat to David and his power and his reign and his rule. From what we've seen of Israel so far, they are unlikely to follow a lame man in a coup. Right? But Mephibosheth is a son of Saul. Well, a son of Jonathan, son of Saul. And Mephibosheth has a son. Right? So there's that note, right? He has a son who enjoys this benefit, who enjoys this position as Mephibosheth's son brought in, is that, that's a risk that David takes, and is that a potential source of future threat? We'll see. Mike. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, whatever else may be going on, it's very clear from what the narrator highlights that it is David's covenant with Jonathan and his desire to be faithful to that covenant, to show love to his brother who is gone. So... There's nothing lovely in Mephibosheth, right, that motivates David's display of love toward Mephibosheth. It is because of a covenant made previously and a desire to keep those promises, which, yes, shows us so much about the character of the gospel and offers us so much assurance, right? God does not show us mercy because we're lovely. Thank goodness, right? God does not extend grace toward us because we have earned it or because we have risen in his estimation. God does not extend mercy toward us to build his client network, right? Or to gain political capital, right? God shows mercy toward us because of a covenant previously made. End of verse 10. I will say, right, we end this chapter with someone now eating at the king's table. Right? And there's much about that that's lovely. And here, the eating at the king's table symbolizes his being raised from this lowly position and enjoying this privilege and this display of love. Right? But joined with that also is there is a sense in which Mephibosheth is dependent on David. Here that's lessened because the land that belonged to Saul is restored and servants are working that land, and so Mephibosheth also has an income from the production of that land. Right? But watch for that. There will be other places in the so-called Deuteronomistic history, right? Samuel and Kings, where someone will be raised up to the level of eating at a king's court. And it's ambiguous when we get there. Is that a sign of hope for those who look to him? Or is that a sign of kind of the final taming of one who could pose a threat to the king who lifts him up to that court? Right? Is it a positive note? Is it a simple note of what happened? Or is it kind of a final sigh? We'll leave that unresolved. All right. Yes, Ron. Call it Mr. M. We'll call it Meth. Yeah.
But my Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Good. What of the land? This land that belonged to Saul, presumably somewhere along the way, is taken away from Saul's house and is now restored to Saul's grandson. And as we've been reading the passage, we know that Saul also had a daughter. Did Michael have a more direct claim on that land? Why was it not restored to her? We know that this is not something that the Bible ignores, right? The question of daughters and inheritance. If we read the book of Numbers, we see the daughters of Zelophehad. And I could go off on that for so long because there is so much at work in what seems this obscure question of inheritance, right? Because the point at which that question is raised by the daughters of Zelophehad, it doesn't matter. Because they're not in the land. Right? The question they raise only matters if they are going to get to the land. And it's near, in the book of Numbers, where we have the incident with Baal at Peor. Right? So if that, as like the golden calf incident of the second generation, if that is going to derail this whole project of entering the land, then their question doesn't matter. So there is a great deal of gospel assurance just in the fact that God takes their question seriously. Because the implication is they are going to get to the land despite the sin of the second generation. Right? Despite the second generation being no better than their fathers. But the question there is, there is a man who has had daughters only and no sons. And so the land that would pass to the daughters, right? Two things can happen, right? The land can pass to the daughters who may marry outside the tribe, and so their tribe will lose some of their inheritance. Or the land will pass to the man's brothers instead, and so that man and his line will lose their inheritance in the midst of their tribe. Right? And so the solution that is developed is they have to marry within the tribe so that, right, their father's line continues to have some of their inheritance, right? But in a way that does not allow that inheritance to be taken up, swallowed up by some other tribe. Right? So this is a question that God takes seriously with inheritance and daughters, and how does that work? I would anticipate that this is probably land that belonged to Saul and then belonged to Jonathan, and so now should, in a line of succession, belong to Jonathan's son, and has been taken, right? Has been taken over or seized by someone along the way, and who that is, we do not know. And Michael has married outside of her tribe, so that inheritance would not follow her, right? Because he would now be part of a new tribe and a new household, and that's further complicated, right, by having two husbands. But I suspect that would be part of why the question of the land that belonged to Saul is never raised with respect to Michael. So.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, it has to stay within the tribe, which is also part of why we have the phenomenon of a kinsman redeemer, right? They can redeem people, but also nearest relatives. If the land has to be sold to pay a debt, right, it belongs to the responsibility of a kinsman redeemer to buy it back, right? Nearest relatives should buy it back so that that land stays within the tribe, right? It remains a possession of the family. So, yeah. That's a good question. I'd love to hear the larger perspective of someone who works with inheritance law and how modern situations in modern law touches on that and have parallels and also things that are quite different.
Would that fall under that particular issue, would that fall under the thing of continuity and discontinuity between old and new?
Yes. So this question of inheritance and the land, right? Does it fall under this broader phenomenon of what parts of Old Covenant versus New Covenant are continuous versus discontinuous? Yes, it would. How, in particular, is a larger question. Yeah. No, it's fine. Right, we're not given the promise, right, of a particular acreage in the Levant. In the Levant, in Palestine, right? Because as those who are heirs of the promise to Abraham, we together with Abraham are heirs of the whole world. Right? But how that works out with specific acreages allotted to you or to me in the new heavens and the new earth, I look forward to finding out. So... we'll see. I'm sure at that point there will be far more interesting things that we can learn than anything I can offer you. For sure. Yeah. So we go into chapter 10. All right. The Davidic utopia continued. Okay. After this, the king of the Ammonites died, and Hanun, his son, reigned in his place. Has David had a good or bad relationship with the king of the Ammonites? Let's leave that question hanging, because it matters for this chapter. And David said, I will deal loyally with Hanun, the son of Nahash, as his father dealt loyally with me. So David sent by his servants to console him concerning his father. And David's servants came into the land of the Ammonites. But the princes of the Ammonites said to Hanun their lord, "Do you think, because David has sent comforters to you, that he is honoring your father? Has not David sent his servants to you to search the city, and to spy it out, and to overthrow it?" So Hanun took David's servants, and shaved off half the beard of each, and cut off their garments in the middle at their hips, and sent them away. When it was told David, he sent to meet them, for the men were greatly ashamed. And the king said, "Remain at Jericho until your beards have grown, and then return." Now, before we start being too hard on the Ammonites, think about half the spy movies you've ever seen. Right? Diplomatic cover works very excellently for spies. For several reasons, right? The people they rub shoulders with are the people they want to keep tabs on and find out information about. They have particular protections as part of the embassy that a traveling businessman wouldn't ordinarily have. Because of those things, they're also under particular scrutiny, and so a close eye, right, a close watch is kept on them. But this is not altogether different, right? Even if we don't have the guns and the bow tie cameras and all of those things associated with it. This is not an entirely unreasonable, out of left field thing for the Ammonites to be nervous about. Especially as David has gone from being a member of Saul's court to now a very powerful and militarily successful king. On the one hand, in the broad scheme of things, it is not unreasonable for them to be suspicious. But David is also a covenant-keeping king. David is one who loves his friends and shows kindness to them. Right? We're reading this off the back of chapter 9, where we've seen this great display of love and loyalty. And that is the background of his relationship with this kingdom. So perhaps it would have been wise for them to be suspicious, but not provocative. Because what do? Do they take them and question them? That was probably part of what they did, right? Right? But this would be the ancient Near Eastern equivalent of disappearing them in a paneled van. Right? And then they show up on a street corner, right? In various ways, deliberately humiliated and sent back. Right? Imagine if we were to take members of the Russian embassy, right? And they disappear for 2 weeks. And then they show up on the Siberian frontier, similarly humiliated and left exposed for the Russians to find them. Is that going to help our international relations? Especially if, and this is where the analogy just utterly breaks down, but especially, right, if the Russians had sent these particular emissaries to congratulate our newly elected president and send best regards, right, and celebrate with him and perhaps bring him some particularly rare vodka, right? And this was our response, right? So, sorry? Right. So how is David going to respond? And note the very subtle thing the narrator does in verse 5. Right? Because this is a crisis moment where David now needs to show himself a leader who knows how to respond both wisely and decisively. And there's this very subtle shift in verse 5. In light of that, when it was told David, he sent to meet them, for the men were greatly ashamed. And the king said, "Remain at Jericho until your beards have grown, and then return." There's a subtle note, right? David's not the shepherd boy brought in from the pastures anymore. David's not some guy who's good with a sword and can dispatch a few Philistines. Right? David is the king. And as the king now, he has to respond to this international incident. Okay, we've got more time. We can keep going. Let's see what he does. When the Ammonites saw that they had become a stench to David, they know what they did. They know they messed up. The Ammonites sent and hired the Syrians of Beth Rehob and the Syrians of Zobah. Syrians are for sale. 20,000 foot soldiers and the king of Maacah with 1,000 men and the men of Tob, 12,000 men. I can do math. That's a force of 33,000, right? And those 1,000 are probably not just Joe infantrymen, right? These are probably the army rangers of the ancient world. And when David heard of it, he sent Joab and all the host of the mighty men. They don't even get a number, right? It's just a host. And the Ammonites came out and drew up in battle array at the entrance of the gate. And the Syrians of Zobah and of Rehob and the men of Tob and Maacah were by themselves in the open country. Where does this battle take place? Near a city. What city do you reckon it probably is? It must be an Ammonite country, right? Because Joab and the mighty men have been sent. And the Ammonites are drawing up in front of a gate. So they are taking a defense, having provoked Israel, they are now on the defensive. So, when Joab saw that the battle was set against him, both in front and in the rear, he chose some of the best men of Israel and arrayed them against the Syrians. The rest of his men he put in charge of Abishai, his brother, and he arrayed them against the Ammonites. And he said, "If the Syrians are too strong for me, then you shall help me. But if the Ammonites are too strong for you, then I will come and help you. Be of good courage, and let us be courageous for our people and for the cities of our God. And may the Lord do what seems good to him." So Joab and the people who were with him drew near to battle against the Syrians, and they fled before him. And when the Ammonites saw that the Syrians fled, they likewise fled before Abishai and entered the city. And then Joab returned from fighting against the Ammonites and came to Jerusalem. But we're not done. But when the Syrians saw that they had been defeated by Israel, they gathered themselves together. And Hadad-Ezer sent and brought out the Syrians who were beyond the Euphrates. And they came to Helam with Shobach, the commander of the army of Hadad-Ezer, at their head. And when it was told David, he gathered all Israel together. We already had hosts of mighty men. Now it's all Israel. And crossed the Jordan and came to Helam. The Syrians arrayed themselves against David and fought with him. And the Syrians fled before Israel. And David killed of the Syrians the men of 700 chariots and 40,000 horsemen, and wounded Shobach, the commander of their army, so that he died there. And when all the kings who were servants of Hadad-Ezer saw that they had been defeated by Israel, they made peace with Israel and became subject to them. So the Syrians were afraid to save the Ammonites anymore. So much to talk about. Yeah, and of course, everything is going beautifully from here, right? Right, as we continue, right, with the Davidic utopia. Next chapter is going to get interesting. But here, right, the geography of Palestine is helpful to know as you're reading the former prophets. The best way to do that is probably actually to take a Bible atlas and read it cover to cover. They're pretty interesting. We tend not to do that. We tend to go look for one thing or another. But one thing that's helpful to know is, A, I can't draw a map. But pretending I could. Right? This is Palestine, and here's the Mediterranean. And in Palestine, we have the Sea of Tiberias, or Sea of Galilee, as is variously known, and the Jordan River, and then the Dead Sea. Right? And Israel is on the west side of the Jordan. And this is out of scale. This is far too large, but we'll ignore that. Right? And Benjamin is the tribe that lives along the border. Israel's up here. Judah's down here. Their neighbors to the east of the Jordan, with whom they're variously in good or bad relationship with, from north to south, spell the word same. Right? So the Syrians, the Ammonites, the Moabites, and then Edom. And of course the Syrians are all over the Fertile Crescent. So this is a spat with the Ammonites, who are hiring the Syrians as well as the further Syrians. So they're all ganging up on David. Right, he's already defeated the Moabites, the Edomites, he has garrisons there. So in this defeat of the Ammonites, which is also a defeat of the Syrians, David has essentially subdued and now collects taxes, right, from the entire east side of the Jordan, as well as directly controlling this United Kingdom on the west side. And as he's expanding the borders of the kingdom here, right, he has also put on notice powerful international, like global superpowers, that I'm here and I'm capable, and so much so that they're not interested in involving themselves in the politics of Palestine anymore. They've done that, they've suffered losses, they said, you're on your own. Right? David's not done in his military exploits, right? Israel is not yet at rest, as they will be, but this is part of developments leading into Solomon's kingdom. Right? The things that David does during his reign are part of why Solomon enjoys peace for so long. But on the map, this is what's happening there. The map is not going to show up for the recording. That's too bad. If you're listening to the recording, you can look in a Bible atlas. But, or you may have a map in the back of your Bible. But that same is helpful for me for remembering who's where in relationship to Israel. All right. We're not going to read chapter 11. But we can read the first verse. Everything's going swimmingly, right? Unless you're an Ammonite or a Syrian. As David's power expands, as Israel enjoys great success under his leadership, it only gets better from here, right? Then we read in chapter 11, in the spring of the year, the time when kings go out to battle, David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they ravaged the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah. So far, so good. But in case we noticed something that's maybe a little bit odd, the narrator adds, but David remained at Jerusalem. All right. We'll see you next week.